brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I don't think we've had one discussion about being undefeated or any of that stuff for 50 years with the guys I played with. Honest to God. I mean, we talk about our kids. We might talk about basketball. We might talk about a funny story, but it's never about being undefeated or anything. Not once. Not once.
Jim Crews won 431 games in his career as the head men's basketball coach at Evansville, West Point, and St. Louis. During his tenure at Evansville, 52 of the 53 players who spent 4 years with the Purple Aces earned a degree. Every senior in Crews' final 12 years graduated. At Army, he graduated all 30 four-year players who came through his program. Counting his time as a player, assistant coach, and head coach, Crews has been a part of 17 NCAA tournaments. He won a national title and went undefeated in 1976 as a senior at Indiana, and won again in 1981 as an assistant coach for the Hoosiers, playing for and coaching with the legendary Bob Knight. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Jim Crews, former head men's basketball coach at Evansville, West Point, and St. Louis. Hey, Hoopheads, this December, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $1,000 off and two free basketballs with a Dr. Dish home purchase. Plus, all their commercial models are $2,500 off this month. Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. You can also check out their holiday gift guide if you're shopping for the ball player in your life.
Hi, this is JP Clark, former NBA assistant coach with the Celtics and Clippers, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Jim Crews, former head men's basketball coach at Evansville, West Point, and St. Louis. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel, tonight. And we are very pleased to be able to welcome to the podcast the former head coach at the University of Evansville, at West Point, and at St. Louis University, Jim Crews. Jim, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, my pleasure. Looking forward to talking to you and Jason.
Absolutely excited to have you on. I want to dive into all the things that you've been able to do in the game, both as a player and as a coach, some of the people that you've been connected to are some of the most well-respected coaches around, and also just all the things that you've been able to do in your career as a head coach at three pretty diverse institutions. So I want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, when I grew up, I grew up in Normal, Illinois, and which is central Illinois, Normal, Bloomington, Illinois. And my dad was a college coach. My dad was a coach at Illinois State. He was an assistant in basketball, football, and baseball. It was kind of a combination of an NIA, which I don't know how this works, to tell you the truth, guys, but NIA and Division II. And then in 1970, Illinois State went to Division I. And Illinois State, kind of a trivia question a little bit, Illinois State, the first African-American Division I coach was Will Robinson. Coach Robinson was from Detroit Pershing High School, and my dad was an assistant coach for him. But even before that, well, so I was always able to go to a gym if I wanted to go to a gym. Now, we always played in the driveway and in the street for football or in the yard for football or baseball and so forth. But when Dad was at practice, I was like always exposed to it. I was very fortunate in our neighborhood. Everyone was, all the boys, tell you the truth, I don't think, except for my sister, I don't even think there was a girl in the neighborhood, but all the boys, my poor sister. But anyway, all the guys were like 2 or 3 years older than me. And I was fortunate that I was good enough that they would let me play, but I was always just getting hammered, which, for myself, that's not going to be for everybody, but, it was a good situation for me because I always had to kind of figure things out. And I thought that really helped me. But with that, and then being exposed with my dad being around facilities and his knowledge and everything, that was tremendous. You know, it's different now than it was when I was growing up. We always just played in the park, played over the school, played in the driveway, played in the street. I never played organized basketball until seventh grade. And we played, well, there's a dispute with my buddies. We either played 6 games or 7 games. That's it. And eighth grade, same thing, 6 or 7 games. And that was it. Didn't play organized football until freshman year in high school. But baseball started about 8 or 9 years old. And so I was lucky. I never got pushed by any coaches to play one particular sport. I enjoyed all three sports. Probably particularly football and basketball. Baseball was good, but it was too windy and too cold in the spring for me in high school baseball. But so that was a great opportunity. Recruiting was different. Recruiting, you got recruited hard still back then, but either I wasn't aware of all the rankings. Certainly there was not all these things that are on the phones and whatever you call it now, the computers and so forth. So it wasn't that way. So, you know, I had an opportunity to go to college. So I was fortunate to get recruited by Coach Knight and go to Indiana. And it was a tremendous experience for us.
What was the process like in terms of making that decision? What were some of the other schools that you considered, that you thought about? And then what ultimately pushed you to decide to go to Indiana and play for Coach Knight?
Okay. First of all, I was going to go to Maryland for the longest time. George Raveling. I don't know if you're familiar with George Raveling.
Yep.
Are you?
Yes, for
you
sure.
Know, great trivia question with George Raveling is George Raveling.
Martin Luther King.
Man, you're good. Yeah. You're good.
Yep.
You're good. Very good. Exactly. So I love Coach Raveling. And that Coach Drissell was the head coach out of Maryland. And so I was very, very strongly interested. Thought I was going to go there for a long time. They probably started, I'm not going to say the earliest, but heavily the earliest in terms of recruiting. I mean, hard Memphis, which Coach Bartow, who came from, well, Coach Bartow went from, I think, Memphis to Illinois, then to UCLA. But Coach Bartow at Memphis, so I visited those schools. You could recruit, well, it's like now, you could visit schools when you were a junior. So I visited, I think, Maryland and Memphis was when I was a junior, and maybe in the fall, I went to Indiana. The difference was, and Coach Knight wasn't Coach Knight. Coach Knight was, you know, no one knew who Coach Knight was. But let me back up a second. In my sophomore year, if I had second parents, my second parents was Art and Betty Swartz, who are in Normal, Illinois also. And Art went to Indiana, and his daughter, Kim, who was a couple, she was 3 years older than I, went to Indiana. And so my sophomore year in high school, Art Swartz said, "Hey, I'm going to go pick up Kim to bring her back for the summer. You want to go over to Bloomington?" And I don't know why I said, yeah, let's go. So I just got in the car. You just kind of did what the older people told you back
right,
then.
For sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, it really was. It's kind of interesting. So we just went over there, and Assembly Hall was being built then. It was not finished then. And so Assembly Hall was there. So that was kind of my first exposure to the campus. Love the campus. It was a beautiful campus. And Assembly Hall was, as I said, was being built. But the Swartzes were very dear to our family, to me. And so that kind of got me in there. And then they, Coach Knight came and visited. And what was different about Coach Knight was he didn't promise anything except you'd have an opportunity, a great opportunity. You're going to have to earn everything that you get. We're going to follow the rules. Even if we don't agree with the rules, we're going to follow the rules. And he goes, probably like everyone else, they want to win a national championship, but he goes, but we're going to do it. You're going to be exposed and surrounded by really good people in terms of, the players. We're not going to have guys that we're going to have similar backgrounds as you have and similar, ways that parents brought you up, just like, your parents did. And that was different. You know, you get promised a lot of things. You're going to start, or you're going to average this many points, or we're going to be on national TV this many times, or all kinds of different things. But he was very direct, very honest, gave you an opportunity. And so that kind of started the process, and then went over the Bloomington one or two other times, and really enjoyed the players. The older players were great with us, and Coach Knight and his staff was tremendous. So just really liked it. It kind of just clicked. It made sense to me to go there. Coach Knight was very similar to how I was brought up and reared with my parents, that you got to earn things, you got to work, and, you know, you got to get along with people and make things happen on your own. You just can't expect good things to happen unless you work.
Was there ever a thought of playing one of your other sports in college, or at that, by the time you got to your junior and senior year, had you kind of pushed those to the side and really decided basketball was where you wanted to be?
Well, I had opportunities to play football. I had opportunities to play football, but I blew or ripped out my tore my rotator cuff.
Oof.
And so that kind of, I was a quarterback, so that kind of eliminated that. I just couldn't throw. I mean, I could throw, but on certain days it just hurt too much. So that eliminated that from that standpoint. But I played baseball my freshman year at IU, and we don't have time. It was a long and short story on that, but it was completely culture shock, because basketball, I mean, we started practice at 3:15, and I mean, you know, you went from one drill to the next, and the one next to the next to the next, and da da da. And you got to listen, you got to do this, and whatever. And then baseball, it was just like kumbaya. It's like you're down in the Bahamas or something. Like you guys are laying around, and guys aren't showing up for practice, and it wasn't a problem. So it was a culture shock from that standpoint. But baseball, I've always had great coaches. I had good grade school. I mentioned basketball. I had an 18-year-old freshman at Illinois State coached us. And he really made a great impression on us. He was pretty tough, but we liked him, and he was fair. And then in high school, baseball, basketball, and football, I was very had great relationships and really enjoy all three of those sports. The different personalities, different way to coach, but they were really good. Baseball in the summer, I had a guy that really, I think, prepared me for Coach Knight. He was a basketball coach at one of our arch rivals, but he was the baseball coach for the Junior Legion team. And he was really tough on us, and he really held us accountable and put a high standard on it. And he was good. He was kind of like Coach Knight, really, in a lot of ways, except he was coaching baseball for us in the summer. So it was good. As many different coaches that I've had and been around, I really enjoyed them all. I really did. They just all did their own thing in their own different way and taught you in a different way. But I liked it.
Was there any one style of coach that you felt like got the best out of you? Because obviously there's all different types of coaches, and clearly the public perception, the stereotype of what Coach Knight was like is one right thing. And then you have a coach who maybe was more like your freshman year baseball coach, where there isn't quite that same level exactly of discipline and that kind of thing. But just when you think about the types of coaches that you played for, what type of coach do you feel like got the best out of you as a player? Because some players obviously mesh better with different types of coaches.
Well, I think probably to answer one, it'd probably be Coach Knight, but that's a little unfair to some of my other coaches, just because, like, for football, my football coach, Coach Kyoto, who is 93 or 94, I just saw him about 6 weeks ago, doing great, looking great, sounding great, still funny. And he was a pretty tough guy, but he allowed me to call the plays when in football. So he gave me a lot of confidence and gave me a lot of responsibility. And so he got me to kind of think like he thought. So I was calling, I'm sure I was calling the plays that he wanted called. Very few times he did that. And so that was just tremendous. That was so much fun, but it was a cerebral thing. And I think that's what Coach Knight, what I enjoyed about him is he taught you how the game worked. He made you think, but thinking really stimulated, I think, not only me, but our whole team. It was very unique. As an athlete, you know, in high school, there's so many things you get away because you're just, you got more God-given ability. Well, right. in college, that doesn't fly too good. So he was giving us the answers to the test all the time with scouting reports, but also in terms of the first year that our freshman year, when that was the first year freshmen were eligible. That's the first year Coach Knight put the motion offense in, which really kind of just changed college basketball for, you know, I don't know how many years, maybe forever, but I mean, a lot of years. And that was very, very mentally stimulating. And that was fun because we all outthought people. And that was, you know, we had good talent. I mean, we had real good talent, but there was always guys that and teams that were bigger and stronger and faster than we were. And so, but thinking wise, we knew that we had the edge, and that was fun. That was a lot of fun.
What did that look like in terms of a practice setting for you as a player, or thinking about it, looking back as sort of with your coaching hat on, in terms of getting you guys to think and being able to go through, especially when you're putting in something new, when you're talking about a motion offense that not a lot of people were running at the time, and you're coming into it as a player and trying to figure that out. What do you remember about how he went about that process of stimulating you guys and getting you to think the game, which then would give you an advantage over your opponent? What did that look like?
Well, first of all, I think that the group that we had as freshmen that came in, and then obviously that we had a freshman group, a big freshman group, and then we had a good big sophomore group who was Coach Knight's first recruiting class. So really good. Steve Green, John Laskowski, great. Doug Allen, great competitor. John Kampster and Steve Allfelt, just really good, great class, and won a lot. But then there was no juniors, and then there was four seniors who were, you know, mature, and those guys were smart. So I can remember really the first day that, you know, it was a completely different practice than how we did it in high school a little bit. High school, we practiced a long time, but we weren't going from one thing to the next thing, and think and move. And but Coach Knight had that. That's how his practice was. But the one thing that I can really remember from the motion offense is the first day Coach Knight put it in, he started explaining, okay, this is what we're going to do on a down screen. And he explained the cutter and explained the passing and explained the screener and how the screener reacts and how the cutter reads and so forth and so on. And then maybe that's all he gave us the first day. And then we kind of maybe played 4-on-4 or something. And he's just kind of getting us to move. And he was figuring it out. But this is what he said. He goes, you guys ask questions. He goes, ask a question. He goes, if I don't know the answer, I'll know it by tomorrow. But I thought that was great because a couple of things. Number one, he is saying, hey, if you don't understand what we're talking about, speak up. And number two is if I don't have the answer, he's saying, I might not have it, but I will figure it out and I'll give you the answer tomorrow. So that made a big impression on me. Obviously, I'm talking about it, whatever, 50 years later or whatever it is. And you know, that's something that really good teachers do. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people think that maybe Coach Knight's reputation that he would do that, but that really opened everybody's eyes. I think that, okay, we're going to think this game and we're going to think it through and we're going to figure this out together. And it was really fun developing kind of the first motion offense in terms of how he ran the motion offense back then. So we thrived on that.
Yeah, that ability to be able to ask a question, I think, is something that, again, looking at it from the outside, that probably not a lot of people, when you think of Coach Knight, that's probably not the first thing that you think of, is that interaction back and forth between coach and player? Because I think a lot of times, even in that era, it wasn't always that common. It was more a case of, like you talked about, hey, you kind of did what the adults told you to do and you really didn't question it. There wasn't a whole lot of asking why, but it sounds like Coach Knight gave you a lot of the why behind what he was doing, which
makes a ton of sense. Yeah, no, he is given the why. Now, there is a time. Practice is a good time, or after practice or before practice is a good time. During the game, that's not a good time to ask any coach. But I mean, seriously.
Right.
I mean, it really isn't. There is a time to discuss things, but the urgency of a game, there's a time limit on everything. So you can't be doing that too much. I'm not saying it never happened, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But that's exactly right. The thing that I really like, there's many things, but one of the things that also is, now I was there 4 years as a player, then 8 years as a coach, and I can only remember really one time. There's a couple. Like, we'd practice from 3:15 to 5:30. I mean, that was, you know, if it was a bad practice, we didn't go longer. We did not do that, which is very, very uncharacteristic of coaches, number one. Number two is that if he felt that something needed to be changed, then he was very adjustable to that. He was very adjustable to that. As many, you know, hey, don't turn the ball over, don't take bad shots, you know, get your knees bent and let's play hard. But everything else was pretty flexible. I mean, it really was. And that's why I think he always evolved. And I think that's why it's kind of mentally stimulating for him. The second thing was that we never ran sprints until our senior year. And I think he didn't believe in sprints. He just thought the practice would condition you for the games, which I think he's 100% right. But the senior year, because we got beat that one game, our junior, so we're 31-1. And I think the only reason we ran the senior, and we didn't run much, but we had run some sprints. And I think that he wanted us to believe that it was a little bit tougher our senior year than it was our junior year. And it really probably wasn't, but he wanted us to think that.
Coaches use those psychological moves all the time, right? To be able to try to get inside their players and get them to perform at their absolute peak. And obviously that final 1976, you guys go undefeated. Just talk a little bit about your memories about that team. And when you guys win the NCAA championship, what was it like being a part of what was obviously a special team, but a team that I'm sure was filled with guys that you have lifelong relationships with. So just talk a little bit about that team and what that experience was like.
Well, first of all, to kind of piggyback on what you said about the coaches getting, you know, playing, not playing, but using psychological things. You really think about it. And how many professions do you have to have? And I'm talking about as an athlete, coaches don't have to physically do anything, with things, but how many professions that every 3 days, once the season starts, every 3 days in college basketball, you got to mentally and physically and emotionally be at your peak and then execute and produce. And there's going to be one winner and one loser every 3 days. That's an amazing thing if you think about it.
It is.
I mean, you got to get excited about playing. You got to get mentally prepared to play, emotionally excited. You got to mentally have a scouting report and mentally know what you're going to be able to do on your things. And so the mental and the physical and the emotion of it being at that level, that is a tough hombre to do. And that's why coaching, it's a tough profession. But those players, they put a lot into it. So sometimes I tease my wife and I will be watching. It doesn't make any difference what sport, but let's say it's basketball and, you know, some kid will miss a free throw and you can just kind of hear people saying, well, how easy that. And I'm going, well, why do they have gimmies in golf?
Right.
I mean, if they're so easy, then why do we have give? We don't have mulligans on the first 5 minutes of the game. You guys get mulligans on the first tee box. I mean, what the heck's that all about?
Right.
You know, so, but our senior year, you know, it was kind of a, we had won three Big Ten championships, and the Big Ten championship was the number one thing. Every, I mean, our freshman year is win the Big Ten championship, and we were able to win the Big Ten championship and go to the Final Four, actually. But then our sophomore year, we won the Big Ten championship. Back then, guys, I think there was only 24 teams, might have been 16, but I think there was only 24 teams that went to the NCAA tournament. And we won the Big Ten championship our second year. We tied with Michigan and then got beat in a playoff. And so we went to a tournament called the CCA, which was all the second place teams in the country. I mean, well, not all of them, but either 8 or 16. I can't remember how many. We played three games, so what would that have been? Eight teams. So there's 24 or 16 teams that went to the league, then the eight. Well, I mean, now they take 68 teams. I mean, my point being, you can finish fifth in your league and go. Back then, we won the Big Ten, didn't go. So anyway, going into our senior year, we'd won three Big Ten championships. That's still the number one thing, is to win the national championship. But now the only thing, the cherry on top of the sundae, was the national championship. And so that's the only thing that was kind of missing from our class's career, is that. And so we had lost great players. And the year before, we were beating teams by 25 to 30 points, literally. I mean, if you look it up, I think we're beating teams by 28 points a game, just smoking people. And so that was had a few close games, but really nothing. Our senior year, after losing that class before us, was, I mean, everyone says, okay, perfect, 32-0, undefeated. That's true, but it was not even close to a perfect season. I mean, we struggled. We bumbled around. We won a lot of close games, which was great, and which is a skill. But you also got to get a little lucky too. But I remember we were up at Wisconsin. We won our fourth Big Ten championship, and that meant, in a way, that means more. We get identified with the 32-0, but I think our class we kind of identify with four Big Ten championships almost more so.
Makes sense.
Than the national championship. And so then we play, and we have the year before, Scott May broke his arm. And then now we're fast forward a year, we're playing Marquette, who's number two in the country, and we're playing them down Baton Rouge, and we're playing them in the Elite Eight. Is that right? Yeah. We beat Alabama, which Alabama was probably the best team we had faced in 2 years. They were great. Really, really good team. Really good team. Great team. But anyway, a couple things that were funny. At least I think they were funny. So we're staying down in Baton Rouge. Well, we're staying at the same hotel as Marquette, the team that we're playing. And I'm sure Coach Knight I never saw him say anything about it, but I'm sure he was not pleased with that. So we'd eat a pregame meal, and then we'd always take a walk. And we'd always, if it's warm out, which in the Midwest it's not too warm, but we'd take a walk to loosen up, get some fresh air. Even if it's 10 degrees out, we'd go take a short walk just to get fresh air instead of being inside all the time. That was just kind of a ritual. We also wore a coat and tie. So we have a pregame meal, and it's like a 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock game. So it's early. So we're taking our walk, and we're just walking, and we look over there, and there's Marquette's team. And well, it's not even all of them. I'd say maybe seven of them are out there. They're not all there together, and they're laying. They got their shirts off, listening to music. Coach Al McGuire.
Coach McGuire might have had a little different philosophy.
He's on a motorcycle ride probably. And we just kind of start laughing. They're probably laughing at us, and we're laughing at us and them, and they're probably laughing at both of them. And obviously, two ways to skin the cat, because Marquette was tremendous, and we were pretty good, and it was kind of lightened the mood for us, to tell you the truth. And but we beat them, and there were so many things that were kind of, I don't know. We played on tartan floor just like we did at Dayton when we got beat the year before against Kentucky in the Elite Eight. Scott May, who played 5 minutes in the Kentucky game because of the broken arm, got in quick foul trouble at the Marquette game. And there was something else. I think we got down a little bit too. And anyway, so that was probably the most emotion in terms of happiness emotion for us, is going to the Final Four and beating Marquette. And then we beat UCLA, who had just won the last 10 out of 12 national championships. We beat them for the second time. We started the season beating them in St. Louis, and we beat them bad, and we beat them pretty good in the semifinals. And then we play Michigan. So what was interesting to me is here, sitting there before the game, just sitting there, and you're thinking about different things. And what I was thinking, I was going, this is kind of amazing. I said, we've played Michigan 4 times in the last 2 years, and we've beaten them every time. And we know that we're better than them. They know that we're better than them. And they know it, and we know it, that they can beat us because they're really good. Yeah. And it's coming down to one game. I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is amazing. All the work that we've done, it's been over 4 years, and all the practices, all the games, and really all the success and everything. And the one thing that we're missing, it comes down to one game for a four-year thing. Because if not, then it would just have been done. I mean, we still would have had a great team and everything else. But without that,
that's a cherry on top.
Yeah, that was a big cherry on top. And really, to tell you the truth, I feel our class is really connected to the class that was ahead of us. And I really feel bad, and all the guys in my class feel bad for the class ahead of us, because we were really one class. It was a class of 9 guys, basically. They had 5. We had 5. 10. It was a class of 10. And, you know, when people talk and it's always about the our senior year. It's not about them at all. They kind of, they've been in the shadows, and it's really unfortunate because they started it. They were Coach Knight's first group. They were tough as nails. They were successful. They were good. They got us everything from how to think and how to practice and how to accept us and so forth and so on. And that always puts a little, kind of tear in my eye about that, yeah, to tell you the truth. Sure.
Which of those guys, which of your teammates are you probably in the closest contact with? Who do you stay in touch with the most?
The guys in my class would be, Bobby does. Bobby lives in Atlanta. Quinn and Scott and Quinn are both in Bloomington. And then Quinn works up here with the Pacers.
Yep.
So those two guys. And then actually Tom Abernathy lives about three blocks from me. So those are the out of the 5 in our class. And that's a neat thing. You know, as I told you in the recruiting, as Coach Knight said, he's going to put guys around you that you're going to enjoy. And you meet guys for the first time when you're 18 years old. And now, literally 50 years later, great friends, always have been. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really what it's all about, ultimately, right? I mean, I think as a coach, that
100%.
That's what you hope that you can establish for your players. And obviously as a player, that's what you hope for in your team situation, that you have guys that you bond with during your time that you're playing with them, and that those bonds continue long after you leave campus or you leave that team.
I was watching a football game the other night, and the Eagles, so they got beat, yep, and they were undefeated. So they mentioned the Miami Dolphins. So the Miami Dolphins always celebrate when the last undefeated team goes. So they're the only undefeated team. No, the last undefeated team. Well, we're kind of the same boat, but we're completely opposite. Honestly, I don't think we've had one discussion about being undefeated or any of that stuff for 50 years with the guys I played with. Honest to God. I mean, we talk about our kids. We might talk about basketball. We might talk about a funny story, but it's never about being undefeated or anything. Not once. Not once.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, again, everybody approaches it differently. And yeah, so you guys aren't cracking the champagne every year with the last undefeated team goes down. When did coaching get on your radar? Was that something, obviously your dad was a coach, so you grew up in a coaching household, but Were you thinking about it while you were still playing, or when did it come on your radar?
That's a great question for me. I never thought I was going to coach. Never. And I'll tell you why. And it was these are dumb reasons. I used to tell our players this because it was, you don't do what I did. So when I was growing up, I really don't know if you might know it. I don't hear this, but like a lot of times, if you were an athlete, you're kind of called a dumb jock.
Yeah.
I don't hear that. I don't know.
Don't hear that as much anymore, but certainly I think when you were a kid or when I was a kid, I'm 52. So yeah, I think you heard that a lot more.
Yeah. You kind of heard that. So it's probably too close to the truth. So that bothered me a little bit. So with me, I'm talking about, and then back then, Mike and Jason, is if you wanted to coach, coaches were a lot of times physical education teachers back then. And Illinois State was it was a teacher's institute back then. I don't know if it still is, to tell you the truth. And so if you coached, you went into physical education. Well, again, for zero assumption, I mean, that was a stereotype. And again, I was probably insecure enough thinking, well, I'm not dealing with this stuff. So I said, I've never coached. So I majored in business at Indiana, never thought about coaching. And then it came to my senior year in college. And then, you know, you kind of start thinking, well, what am I going to do? I knew I wasn't playing in the NBA, which is an interesting story too. In fact, this is when I knew I wasn't going to play in the NBA. It's funny how things think. We're playing Minnesota my freshman year, and it's one of those games where you're in your area. Bill Musselman's from your area.
Yep,
right?
For sure. He's from Brecksville. Yeah. Yep,
exactly. So Bill Musselman, Coach Knight, they competed against each other. So they had a big competitive thing going. Minnesota had won the Big Ten championship the year before. And that same year, they got in a big fight with Ohio State. I mean, if anyone wants to Google that, it's an ugly scene.
That was the Luke Whitty.
That's exactly right. Remember that? And so anyway, they had guys like, people don't know these guys, but Clyde Turner's like 6'9", Jim Brewer's like 6'8", Ron Behagen was like 6'7", 6'8". They had a guard named Nix who was 6'4", and he was the smallest guy. So they had Dave Winfield was also like 6'6". So they had this big team. Okay, well, we weren't very big. Our center was 6'7", and, you know, we weren't very big that freshman year. And it's one of those electric games. I mean, it's stoked. The atmosphere is stoked. I mean, everything is stoked. And it's an afternoon game, and game goes on. And all of a sudden, there's a loose ball. And the loose ball is like, you know, 8 feet from me. And there's like three Minnesota guys, and they're like 12, 14 feet away from the ball. And two of those suckers beat me to the ball. And right then I go, golly, not only are they bigger than me, they're faster and quicker than me. I said, I got no chance for the pros. That's dead serious. I knew I'd never be a pro then. So anyway, senior year, thinking, what I do? I said, maybe I should coach. I don't know. But anyway, I got a job, but in the spring, I had a job in the spring already for the next fall or next summer. But Coach Knight offered me a coaching job, and I turned it down.
Wow.
And went into business for 1 year, and then had the opportunity to come back the next year. So I was very, very fortunate to get two offers instead of one. Very, very. I mean, you got to be lucky to get one offer, and I was really lucky to get two. But as soon as I started coaching, I mean, within a day or two, I go, I really, this is what I really enjoy. So I was very, very blessed and very fortunate to coach with him for 8 years. And that was when the Pan American Games were going on. The Olympic Games were going on when he was the coach of both those. So that was a lot. We had good teams. We won a national championship with Randy Whitman and Isaiah Thomas and Ted Kitchell, Landon Turner, those guys. And so a lot of good stuff that was going on in Bloomington, but then obviously kind of globally also.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio. powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe Stecision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered. All right, so I have like a million questions from this era, but I'm going to start with two. First question is, what initially you said after a day or two, you knew that this is where you wanted to end up, that it was the right place for you. So what did you love about coaching initially right out of the gate? And then the second part of the question is, what was it like to transition from being a player under Coach Knight, where you have that player-coach relationship, to all of a sudden now you go to now you're a colleague of Coach Knight as opposed to a player. So first of all, what did you love about coaching? And then just what was the transition like with Coach Knight going from player to coach?
Well, from a coaching standpoint, I thought right off the bat, it's a puzzle. It's a puzzle. So each player and other things also, because it's a program, but let's just take the players and team. The players, each of those players is a piece of a puzzle. And you're trying to get that piece the best it can be. And then you're putting the puzzle together to make a really good team. And the pieces fit differently at all times. It's always evolving. It's changing. And I thought that was just really stimulating. I thought it was just really, because what you're trying to do is have guys with tremendous individual ambition, but a collective responsibility. And you got to get that balance. And that's hard because, you know, we all have that selfish gene in us, and to be a part of something that's bigger than yourself, you got to really, you know, kind of conquer that selfish gene in us. So I just thought that was, it was just really stimulating to put those pieces together. And I really just enjoyed it. And to be truthful, I probably thought like a coach because I was always, as I said, even from my neighborhood, you know, playing with older kids, I was always trying to have, I had to figure out how to survive.
Right.
And that's kind of how coaches, I think in terms of doing things also. So, and then from the relationship with being a player to a coach, it was really great. I mean, because, you know, from a coach, when you're around a head coach, or assistant coaches for that matter, is, you know, you see them for 3 hours. I mean, that's all you see them for 3 hours. That's it. You don't see them any other time. I mean, on the road, you see them a little bit more, but at home, you don't see them more. And as a coach, you know, I was able to see, Coach Knight, you know, with his buddies. Or, you know, we'd go play golf. We played tennis. We, you know, we'd go to the movies. We'd be in a car for 6 hours recruiting together. We'd be in a hotel room together. I mean, you're over his house.
Right.
You know, it's around his family. You know, he's around our family, you know. And so completely different than when you're a player. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, too, because in today's age, you know, a lot of kids are always saying, you got to have this relationship with the coach and your relationship with the coach. Well, I'm not saying that, you know, relationship's good. That's fine. But I think it's kind of sometimes it gets to be a buddy-buddy kind of thing.
There's a fine line there, right? I mean, there's a fine line.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I remember Calvert Chaney?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, he's the leading Big Ten scorer. Well, Calvert, who is from Evansville, where we used to coach, and then he ended up being on our staff at St. Louis, and there's no buddy better than Calvert. He's just an awesome individual and a really good coach, too, but awesome individual. But, I mean, Calvert, so we're just talking one day, and he goes, Because why would a kid want a relationship with the head coach? He goes, like, the head coach is 40, 50 years old. Like, I don't want to be, he goes, I didn't want a relationship with a coach. I want to get along with them, but I don't want this, you know, tight relationship. I said, when I'm 20, I don't want to go out with my parents, or I don't want to go, you know, hang with, you know, Uncle Joe all the time, you know.
Different era.
It's like they think that's, and maybe they do it. I don't know. But anyway, so seeing it from a different, more of a human, instead of just the coach, you know, you can, coach had a good sense of humor, and he had some good friends, and there was a lot of laughter going on. And you'd see that a little bit as a player, but you didn't see it, not nearly like you would as a coach. So I really enjoyed that. And so we had a good relationship, coach and I. I enjoyed it. I thought from a teaching standpoint, he gave his assistants a lot of responsibility. He did not micromanage much at all. The 8 years I was there, he didn't micromanage. I mean, you know, you had to get your things done. He gave it, but he didn't look over your shoulder. You know, he expected you to produce and get things done however and have things prepared. But I like that. And he also gave, there was only one thing that there was film exchange back in my day where you exchange films with, you know, like we'd exchange films with Ohio University because they played Ohio State or something like that. Well, that I didn't do that, but everything else in the program, from recruiting to scouting to scheduling to budget stuff to travel to whatever, camps to clinics to organizing the Pan Am trials or the Olympic trials, he let us do that stuff. And that was awesome. I mean, that was really awesome. And then he let you coach. The assistants did coach, and he overlooked it, and then he would interject, or if he needed to take over a little bit, he'd take over a little bit, but he wanted you coaching all the time. You weren't there watching him coach. You were not there watching him coach.
I'm sure for you going forward in your career, obviously that was a huge plus in your development as a coach, to be able to have somebody that empowered you to be able to do all those things and have a hand in all those different parts of the program. It's funny because now we'll talk to coaches, Jim, that obviously at different levels, you know, if you go in, you start out as a director of ops at the Division I level, you have a different experience compared to somebody who's coming in as a Division III assistant in terms of just the number of people on the staff, the number of things that you get to do. And I think guys have different feelings about where they start and what they learn in their first couple of positions that helps them to kind of advance along the way. So I'm sure for you that you look back on that time and being able to have your hands in all those different facets of the program, I'm sure was invaluable to you as you went on to the rest of your career.
100%. It was a little like playing from the standpoint, like coach would practice the first day of practice. He didn't slow things down for freshmen. Like, he just threw you in the water and you got to start learning how to swim, or better.
Yep.
You better hang on to someone, or you better watch someone else learn to swim. And he did that as coaching too, is here it is. This is your, figure out who we're going to play and then let's go. Or this is what you're doing with recruiting. Let's go. And, so it was great. Like you just said, it was a great, background and foundation to become a head coach. I mean, it was, and that's what he wanted. He wanted coaches to become head coaches. And so that was, I couldn't have been at a better place at a better time than Indiana and with Coach Knight when I was there.
Tell us a little bit about coaching Isaiah Thomas. What was Isaiah like as a college player? Obviously goes down as one of the greatest players in the history of the game, but just what was it like coaching a guy that ended up not only achieving what he did in college, but also what he went on to do in the professional level?
Well, I'll start with the recruiting. It was really interesting. So back then, again, I have no idea what the rules are now, and they might have been, they're probably different than, I know they're different than when I was even coaching 5 years, 6 years ago. But anyway, back then you could go into the home and, you know, you could take anyone you wanted to in the home, let's say. So when we recruited Isaiah Thomas, we had a guy on our staff named Tommy Miller. Tommy played for coach at West Point, and Tommy was from Chicago. And Tommy Miller played for the same high school coach, Coach Pingator, who just passed away about 2 years ago, who was Isaiah's coach at St. Joe's. And so Tommy did a lot. And what, another thing with recruiting, Coach always kind of had the, our staff, and even when I was getting recruited by Indiana, the whole staff recruited you. It just wasn't one person, which I think's a big plus too in a lot of ways, which I won't go into, but I think that's a real positive. So anyway, the night that they go into Isaiah's home, and Isaiah's in a rough neighborhood. And so it's Tommy Miller and it's Coach Knight and it's Wayne Embry, who was the general manager of the Milwaukee Bucks, who was a close friend of Coach's. It was, I'm trying to think of the other guy. It was a doctor, Dr. Bamba, in Bloomington, and Quinn was there, and Quinn Buckner. So they go in the home, and I don't know how long they were in there, Mike, but they couldn't tell who's in this house, doesn't live in this house. There are people coming in. There are people going out. It was very confrontational by some of Isaiah's brothers, with Coach. They're leaving, and it ends up, Isaiah had a brother that had a drug problem, and he also had a brother that was a police officer. They're literally fighting in the street as these guys were getting in the car. Wow. So I was not there. So I get in the office early the next morning. So I call up Quinn. I said, "Hey, what went on?" He goes, "You wouldn't believe it." And he tells me a story. And then I call up Dr. Baum. I said, "Hey, how'd it go last night?" And he goes, "You wouldn't believe it." And he tells me a story. And I did that with everybody was there, Wayne Embry, everyone. And they never told me the same story. There were so many stories going on that night. They couldn't even keep track of it because there's a story going on the staircase. And then there's a story in the, at the same time, maybe in the living room. So anyway, what makes it interesting is Coach calls up Coach Pingator. I don't know if it was the next day or 2 days later, and calls him up and goes, "Ping," and Ping loved Coach and Coach loved Ping. And he goes, "Ping, this is not going to work out." He goes, "This is not the right place for Isaiah. It's just not the right place." And so they talked and it was good. And he goes, "Okay," and everything. And I don't know, 4 hours later, 2 hours later, I don't know when, but very short time, Isaiah calls Coach. And he goes, "Hey, I'm coming to Indiana." And, this is kind of funny because, here's obviously one of the highest recruited guys in the country. And, we just told him he's not coming. And now he's telling us he is coming. And Coach goes, "No, you can't come." He goes, "I'm not giving you a scholarship." And Isaiah said, "I don't care." He goes, "You can't stop me. I'll walk on. I'll just come and pay my way." So it's interesting how things work out. Obviously, he got a scholarship and it worked out great. And Isaiah, I always said, now Isaiah, I don't know how tall. He's not very tall. He's 6 foot, I guess. I don't even know if he's 6 foot. I don't know what they listed him as, but I always thought watching Isaiah in high school and everything else, I said, you know what? If we're playing for the Big Ten championship, and there's a rebound that needs to be had and for the championship, Isaiah's going to get it. I don't care about those 6'8", 6'9 guys. And that's what Isaiah was. Tremendous competitor. Very, very good. He's very, very close. Like the teammates that he had at Indiana, Landon and Ray, but Randy Whitman and Ted Kitchell and those guys, Jimmy Thomas, those guys are very, very close. He was a good teammate. He was very, very respected with those guys, and especially all the hoopla he got. And the 2 years he was there, we won two Big Ten championships. But we struggled. I mean, the year that we won the national championship in 81, we were 7-5. We got like seventh place in a Hawaii tournament out in Rainbow Tournament out in Hawaii. So it wasn't an easy process, but, finally got there and it clicked right at the right time and kind of went through the NCAA like no other.
A guy like that, obviously just being able to be around him day in and day out and seeing, I think you hit it on the head in terms of the competitiveness. And when I think about Isaiah Thomas, that's probably the first thing that comes to mind is just how competitive he was, and a guy at his size to be able to do what he did both at the college level and then in the pros, I think is a testament to what kind of a competitor that he was. You mentioned earlier about getting a chance to be around Coach Knight with the Olympic trials in 1984. So how much were you around, able to see? I know there's the famous Bob Knight quote of calling Jordan, saying he has the opportunity to be the greatest player in the history of the game before he sets foot on an NBA court. Kind of very, obviously, a pretty accurate prognosis from Coach Knight. But just, were you around any of that at the trials? And just what do you remember about that, if you were?
Oh, yeah. I was I scouted for the Olympic team. So I had to go South America, Italy, Canada, wherever, all over the place to scout for them. But the Olympic trials was in Bloomington, which was just a tremendous thing. Coach Knight, the collection of coaches, and I'm not going to remember them all right now, but, you know, like Big House Gaines from Winston-Salem and Judd Heathcote from Michigan State and Diggerfeld from Notre Dame and C.M. Newton, who was on the Olympic staff from, he was at Vanderbilt at the time. And I can't remember them all, but I mean, it was kind of the who's who, but all these guys would get in the room after every practice. So we'd have two or three practices during the trials, probably three. We'd probably have, yeah, kind of like drills and a little scrimmage and then drills, a little scrimmage and then scrimmage at night. And then after each one, we would, Coach and I would get at the board, and this, our locker room wasn't very, very big, the IU locker room really. And, but all these guys would just jam in there, and then they'd kind of have column A, column B, column C. And, you know, A was the top players, B's the next, and then C's. But it would be changing after each practice, each session. Okay, let's move this from B to A, and this one from A to whatever, C to B, and B to A. And so that was it. And getting the insight of those guys, just evaluating guys, and looking at that. And then watching that, and then you just had tremendous guys. I mean, you know, guys that didn't make the team, Terry Porter, John Stockton, Charles Barkley. I mean, those guys are pretty good. And, but the, you know, it, and it wasn't maybe the best 12 players. It was the collection of 12 players to make the best team for. And obviously that was great. So then the 4 weeks of practice before they went to the thing, I was there, every day with that. So that was fun. Just to watch guys, and is interesting. Sam Perkins from North Carolina, who's a 6'10", long armed, long legged player. You know, his reputation was kind of like he's a little bit laid back, a little lazy. And he was my favorite player, really. I mean, he was a winner. He was competitive. And I said, yeah, he doesn't look like he's running very fast, but he beats everyone from point A to point B all the
there's
time.
There's some guys that are like that, Jim, isn't there? Oh, I mean, there's some guys that just don't look like they're going hard all the time, and man, do they go hard.
He's the Freddie Couples of basketball, Sam Perkins. I mean, just nonchalant. And I can remember once, too, is like Coach Knight was really upset with the team, and they had played an exhibition game, and Coach was – he was ticked at him, and he was on him, and he's on him. And then in the locker room, so Coach is gone, and they had the next game coming up or something. And Sam Perkins just speaks up. He goes, "Hey, Coach is upset." He goes, "That's his problem. We got a game to play. Let's go." You know, but that, I mean, Coach Knight loves stuff like that. I mean, that's exactly what Coach Knight would want. And so, yeah, those guys, that those were competitive things. Now those Olympic trials and Olympic practices, I mean, those were, they got after it, those guys. And Jordan was a guy that, you know, he went from a guy that, you know, we played him that year. In fact, his last game, college game, was against Indiana. We beat him. We upset him. And that was, Jordan was an all right shooter. I mean, he was all right. But I mean, at the Olympic, so whatever happened after that game in Atlanta, when we played him in Atlanta in spring to the Olympics, that dude got a lot better shooting. I don't know what he did, but he got a lot better shooting. I mean, that guy was really competitive on things, but really the whole team was. I mean, Patrick Ewing was there, and Joe Klein and Alvin Robertson was there, and Leon Wood, and really good. I mean, the best of the best.
Yeah. I mean, just to be able to see and to be in that environment, to be around those guys. And obviously, as you said, as a coach, to be around the coaches that were associated with it. Again, something that not everybody gets an opportunity to do, and I'm sure that it served you well as you move forward. Let's jump to the opportunity that you get at Evansville. Talk about how that opportunity comes to you, and then what you remember about that first experience in your early years there as a head coach.
Well, Evans was great. It opened up in 85, in the spring of 85. And that was the first kind of year that I was kind of the year before the Olympics and all that was coming up, and Coach and I talked, and it was just best that I stayed in Bloomington that particular year, which was great. I loved it. And we had a good year, and the Olympic experience was a once in a lifetime thing. And then, so he coach came in and he goes, "Hey, that Evansville job is open. Would you be interested?" He goes, "Yeah, I think that might be good. I don't know a lot about it, but I think that might be pretty good." And ironically, I had seen Evansville when I was a little guy, Illinois State, when my dad was coach, and they went to the finals, and the Division II finals were in Evansville, and Winston-Salem won it with Earl Monroe. And Big House Gaines, who I mentioned was at the Olympics in 1984, was the coach. And that was like 1967. And so, in fact, a side note to that a little bit. So when I was a little guy, Winston-Salem, they came out and they wore these cowboy hats. I was a little guy, I thought this was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. These guys warmed up with cowboy hats on. And I don't know why I thought that was cool, but I thought that was cool. So fast forward to the 1984 Olympic trials, and we're having a big dinner late at night at some barbecue place, and I'm sitting there with a ton of coaches at my table, or not my table, but our table, and Big House Gaines is either sitting right across from me, right by me. I said, "Coach Gaines, I said, I want to know the story behind those cowboy hats. I said, I thought that was the gray. I said, why do you guys wear that cowboy?" And his whole face complexion completely changed. Like, he just got ticked. He goes, "Oh my gosh." He goes, "This clothing store, who's a sponsor of the tournament, they made us wear those hats. Those were the stupidest." I mean, I just irked him off to no end. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. So I thought
that's funny.
Yeah. So where were we going with this? I'm sorry. What were we talking about? Evansville. So anyway, the AD at Evansville was a guy named Jim Byers, who was he used to be the football coach at Evansville. He played football at Michigan when he was young. His dad was a legendary coach in Evansville at a high school. In fact, their team never got scored on one year. They shut out every team one year.
Wow.
Yeah, that is a wow. And so, but Coach Byers, he came up, and it was still during the season in February, and we had a game, and he came up for the game, and then we met like for 4 hours in Coach Knight's office. And this is what was awesome about Coach Byers. I mean, we talked for 4 hours, and everything he said was exactly true and honest. He did not, and that's how he was as an AD and a boss. He was such a tremendous leader and tremendous AD for our, well, he was there about 15 of the 17 years I was there. And I couldn't have gotten any luckier. I mean, I could not have gotten any luckier. It was a perfect match of my personality with Evansville and what Evansville is kind of looking for and what they are, and just the town is a great place to rear our children. And it was a, you know, Evans was only about 2,200 kids at the most, 2,000 kids. But we'd start winning, and we were getting 10,000-12,000 people at games. And so that was cool. So we had a kind of a big time. We had a big time atmosphere, but a very small private college experience for the students, athlete on that. So that was fun. That was fun. We had a lot of great relationships there. We wore the sleeves. That was very famous back in the day. We wore did you know about the sleeves or
yes,
not?
Yes. Yes.
Did you?
Man, yeah.
You heard.
The t-shirts.
Yeah. Yes, the t-shirt. Yeah. Well, we wore those in honor of Coach McCutcheon. Jerry Sloan went there, who played for the Utah Jazz and was a great coach of the Utah, or played for the Bulls, but then the Utah Jazz. Jerry played there, and they won 5 national championships during Coach McCutcheon's time, and they used to wear those sleeves. I have no idea why they wore those sleeves exactly, but in those honor, because that's the only reason we were in the position we were at Division I and kids getting scholarships is because of those guys. And so we did that in their honor and what it represented in terms of how things, what we believed in terms of kids graduating, following the rules and giving back to the community. And so we were very proud of those sleeves.
When you think about your time there at Evansville, and obviously there you're there a long time, if you had to point to one or two keys to what you felt like allowed you to have the success that you did there, whether that be something culture-wise or something on the floor that you guys did, I don't know, just pick out one or two things that you think were key to your success.
Well, I think, well, first of all, we had kids that I think understood who they were as players. They weren't the most talented. They had good talent. They weren't the most talented, but again, it came with, they were tough, competitive and smart, and they were willing to fight for what they felt was right and what we felt was right and how college basketball should be played up. And they really kind of had a chip on their shoulder about that for a long time. So they were very, very in tuned with how things should be done. When we had great, once that thing got, Marty Simmons changed our whole thing. Marty was a great player in high school. They went 68-0, Lawrenceville, Illinois. He went to Indiana, played against Jordan's team in 84. Yeah. And then played in 85 as a sophomore, but then he transferred and we were lucky enough to get Marty there. And Marty had to sit out. Back then he sat out as a transfer and he changed how these guys thought. I mean, in terms of how to go to class, how to act in class, how to prepare for practice, how to prepare for games, how to work in things, how to think, how we're going to be a team, changed our whole culture, changed our whole mentality. And we were fortunate the first year, Marty, we won a championship our first year with Marty there. And so then we really had strong leaders within it was a very much a player driven leadership thing there. So we were fortunate to get guys that thrived on that. And, you know, we had a really good leader. His name was Scott Schreffer. He's about 6'1" and he was good, but he was smart. Like if anything came up, he'd kind of challenge another player, but he always had a kid who was 7'1" behind him, Sasha Hootman, when he was going after this kid that was 6'5". So we had some smart guys. So I just think that they knew how to play and they were very unselfish guys and really thrived on. We had a tremendous atmosphere there in Evansville and they thrived on that thing. They were willing to work and get after it. And, you know, we kind of told them how it was going to be in recruiting. So we didn't try to sugarcoat anything. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. We're going to work, but, you know, here's the good things too. So here's the good, bad, and ugly. And we had enough guys that showed up that enjoyed that. And that's, you know, it goes for that individual ambition and collective responsibility, trying to get that balance. That's the whole thing.
How do you develop leaders on your team? How did you do that over the course of your career? Was there something that obviously – you can look for in the recruiting process, look for kids who have those leadership traits, but still you as a coach have to sort of provide the environment to allow that leadership to thrive. Is there anything that you could point to that maybe a coach that's listening that they could take from some of the lessons that you learned about trying to develop leaders on your team?
Well, I think having conversations with them in terms of what you expect from them and what you want from them and say, these things are going to happen. For example, even from this standpoint, you could say, and it didn't happen a lot, but I'd say 3 or 4 times over the years, or maybe more than that a little bit. But, you know, I'd bring a leader in and I'd go, you know what? You know, everyone knows that you're the leader, but we're not getting much. I'm all over you today. I'm all over you today. And you know what I expect? I expect how you're going to, everyone's going to look and see how you respond when I'm on you. But I'm telling you, I'm going to be on you. And that worked out good because they got a heads up that I'm on them. Right. A little bit. And then they're going to respond in the way that needs to be respond, how they need to respond. And then that gets guys to go. So if you tell them what we're trying to do, or, hey, you know, so-and-so, he's struggling. You know, this guy's struggling with, you know, something, maybe it's personal, you know, and you might not tell him, or you might tell him, it just depends on what personal thing it is. But I mean, it's like, hey, this guy needs, he needs a buddy now more than ever. He needs encouragement right now more than ever. You give him that thing. Or, hey, you need to get so-and-so straightened out. I mean, he ain't thinking the way that we need to be thinking right now. If we're going to be as good as we need to get, you need to get him and get two of those other guys, or you and three of you talk to him and do that. And so, you know, it's just whatever situation kind of comes, is you just bring them in the fold and explain it to them. And most of them are very receptive to that. Most of them enjoy that. And you know, when you grow up, everyone says, you know, your parents, your teachers, your coaches, man, I wish I was the boss so I can boss everyone around. Well, yeah, that's all fine until you're responsible for all the guys that you're bossing around right. A little bit. And so they get a completely different take on that. And so I think just putting them in the loop and being honest with them and tell them what you expect, not only from them, but from the team. And this is what we're missing right now. And, you know, in coaching, it's a day by day thing. I mean, that because if you got to be ready every 3 days emotionally, emotionally and mentally and physically, and then you got to practice. I mean, you can't just lallygag around in practice and then expect guys to figure. So it's got to be, you got to hold guys accountable in practice. And so that's the grind, and it's a long grind. And I think the more kids hear your message besides your voice, the better it is. For example, we might call up a parent. You need to talk to your son. Mom, talk to your son. Oh, you know, or it could be vice versa. Hey, Curtis, I called your mom last night. As Curtis's eyes got about 2 inches wide, like, oh my gosh, I said, I can take your stuff, but I can't take my mom's stuff, you know? And so the more that they're involved with it, then they know it's their team. I mean, they know it's their team, and that's what we promoted. They got to believe in the program. They got to believe in the program. They got to believe in their teammates. And they got to believe in themselves. That's what you got to constantly get them to do. And sometimes, you know, I can remember we had a really, really, really good player, and I asked him, like, who's better, this other kid on this other team or you? Well, he said the other kid on the other team. And I mean, I just crucified the kid, to tell you the truth. I just killed him. But my point was, like, wait a minute, you're not believing in yourself? Like, you need, you know, and, but it's the same thing. It's like your children. They all respond differently. Marty Simmons, I'd tell him that was the dumbest shot I've ever seen in my life. And Scott Hafner, his best buddy, was on the team, who was a great shooter, got 65 points in one game, actually. I'd come over and say, hey, Scott, you just need to keep taking those shots, but you just need to get your feet underneath. I mean, completely different. You could,
yep.
Completely different personalities, and you got to figure out what makes them tick a little bit.
And that changes, right? Year to year, player to player, the good coaches are adaptable. And then are
100%. And it changes from player to player, from year to year, because they go from freshman, sophomore, junior, senior.
For sure.
And even during the season. I mean, you know, the same kid, sometimes he needs a kick, but sometimes he needs a pat. I mean, that it might even be in the same practice.
Yep.
I mean, that's what's really, you know, and that's what's really hard, I think, in life, actually, in my opinion, is, you know, sometimes you just don't know what that person needs, you know, and that's hard because, you know, you always want to put the person in position to be successful as they can be. And sometimes you just don't know, a lot of times you just don't know what's going on with an individual. You just don't know. And I can give you a great example. We had a kid, his mother was killed in a farming accident. They were farmers. And when he was like 9 years old, so he comes out and says, boom, 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 boom. So now we're playing, and he was tough as nails. He's one of the toughest kids we've ever had. Tough, tough kid, good player, tough. Tough. Great. I mean, if you knocked him down, he'd get up and pat you on the rear end, Mike, and hey, that's good. He'd smile at you like, that's good. He would appreciate you knocking him on his butt because he liked competition. Now, he's going to get you back. I'm not talking about dirty, but that's, he loved competition, and he was just great. Well, so we go to Hawaii. I'm trying to get this all down. So we go to Hawaii, and, you know, there's some parents on the trip. And some of the parents were just moms, or the dads didn't go. So, you know, let's say there's five moms on the trip or something, maybe six, and everything, because everyone can't afford that. And so we do that. And then, so the mom, and now it's over Christmas. It's over Christmas and New Year's. That's when we're there, New Year's and Christmas. So that's an emotional thing for a lot of people. And then we're coming back on the flight, and it's New Year's Eve, and it like strikes midnight when we're on this flight. And so it's all joyous, and a lot of these moms are, you know, they're hugging their boys and giving them a kiss. Well, it doesn't register with me. And, you know, like we practice either a day or the next day, and then all of a sudden, you know, something doesn't go right in practice, and this kid's gone. I mean, he goes AWOL for 3 days. 3 days. Well, this thing was all catching up. I didn't connect the dots. You know, he didn't have a mom. We had all these moms on the flight. Wow. Yeah. It's over the holidays. That's when you miss your loved ones, over the holidays. And then it's reinforced on New Year's Eve, because all this joyous stuff going on with New Year's Eve on the flight, and he's not part of it. And so, you know, I was an idiot. I didn't connect any of the dots. And then he came back, and he's been great, and he's an awesome guy and everything else. But he was just going through something at that time. And that's, you know, that's what makes it tough, I think, sometimes in life. And that's coaching, not coaching. I think it's just, you just don't know what makes.
Right. You don't know what's going on behind closed doors, right?
You just don't know.
That speaks to everything that you were talking about earlier, Jim, about just having communication with your guys and talking to them and trying to figure out what makes them tick and how each guy's different. And even when you're doing that all the time, there's still things that as a coach, as a boss, as a parent, as a friend that you can miss that, you know, you don't always catch. But I think what you're trying to do, especially as a coach, is you're trying to get to know those kids and understand them and understand their situation so that, again, you can get the most out of them and so that they can get the most out of themselves, which ultimately is what anybody wants to do as a coach, is to try to maximize what your players can be as people and as basketball players and what your team can be collectively as a group, like you talked about at the very beginning.
That's 100%. And I think also if you got guys that, and we were fortunate at Evans and everywhere we were, and fortunate at Indiana too, if you have players that are of like ilk, in terms of kind of believing what you believe. Well, I mean, we all got different personalities. That's a good thing. But sometimes the players are going to know things that the coaches don't know, and they can help too if they're the right kind of guys. You know, you're just not on the team. You are the team. And if you are the team, then that means you got, you know, 10, 12 guys around you. And it's not maybe all 12 of them, but there's going to be three or four that are close enough, really close enough to you to join forces to you when tough times come. And really my best memories, as many championships as I've been very fortunate to be around and for 40 years, is really the top highlights were things that were off the court when players stepped up and did things that were just off the chart. I mean, just to give you one quick example, we had a kid. I can't remember what year that would have been, but it's June 20. It was June 28th. I know what date it was of the month. And anyway, he just had graduated, and he was working camp, and it was something that I was like an hour or two away for something, and I was coming back. And anyway, he had asked our equipment man if he could put his wash dirty clothes in the dryer. And I, year or two, probably young, but they used to have these dryers that were just these enormous things. Well, I don't know, back in the day, I guess when you could stick your arm in dryers and it would stop when he sticks his arm in this thing and it just grabs it and rips it and tears it apart. And I mean, it's just bleeding everywhere. It's just bleeding everywhere. So anyway, try to speed up the story a little bit. So two guys, Price, two of our, he's screaming. Well, they think he's just screwing around, number one. And then they finally come in there. They basically save his life, get that bleeding, get it, call the ambulance. Boom. He gets helicoptered over to Louisville. Boom. Or I don't know what. Yeah, it was probably a helicopter. I don't know what. He got over to Louisville some way on the flight. And so anyway, they set up a schedule. And so he's going to be in the hospital. You know, he's in the hospital for a month or 5 weeks or something like that. And so they just put a big calendar on the board. Okay, who's going today? Who's going tomorrow? Who, you know, it could be two guys, three guys, one guy. It doesn't make a difference. But every day someone was going to go there. Every day. Coaches, players, every day. Every day they're going, we're going to drive to Louisville, see him, drive to Louisville, see him, drive to Louisville. And what was cool about it is so the team is trying to make this guy, his name was Milt Donald out of Cincinnati. That's where he's from. He's an awesome guy. And Milt, you'd go in there and you're trying to make him, you'd leave and he's making you feel good. that's when you know you have special guys and special teams. Definitely. But stories like that, there's been those kind of stories are so much more meaningful, as wonderful as championships are. And even some teams when you don't have championships, obviously are good too, but championship, those stories like that have always touched me in a much more profound way.
Yeah. I think when you look back as a player or as a coach, a lot of times those games can run together, the wins, the losses, especially you talk about teams that you play in your conference that you've played multiple times. You're trying to remember when was that game and this game. But what you really remember, again, are the people and the relationships that you have. And that's really what it's all about when you, what it comes down to. And clearly, a day-to-day, you're trying to win games. And ultimately, especially at the college level, you're being judged on your one loss record. But the impact that you have on players and that story that you just told, clearly, that's a story that everybody who was involved in it benefited from that experience and remembers it to this day. And it'll always be meaningful in their life. And that's really what it's all about.
Looking to grow your coaching? United Basketball Plus has over 3,000 plays and 45 deep dive courses with some of the best minds in the game, including Tyler Costin, Paul Kelleher, Tobin Anderson, Dave Love, and more. You can also view their United Basketball clinics and receive 50% off in-person clinics. United Basketball Plus is partnered with Jordan and Joe's Decision for their skill development curriculum. United Basketball Plus is a one-stop shop to help you grow as a coach, leader, and culture builder. Follow the link in the show notes and use the code CLINIC to receive an annual membership for just $50.
We used to tell the teams all the time this, and it is so true. And I mean, you don't know it when you're real young, but like, you can't fool the locker room. We you know, players, we can, players and coaches, we can fool the fans. We can fool the media. We can fool our girlfriends or wives. We can fool. You cannot fool the locker room. They know what is true. Period. They know all our good, bad, and ugly of it. So it better be more good than ugly
It
because it's about relations. So who is not, you know, who's selfish, who's not selfish, who's going to be mature about it, who's not going to be mature about it, who stepped up when they need to step up. In other words, who's authentic and who's not authentic, basically. That's what it is. And so that's why recruiting is so important, because there's nothing more important than that locker room. And because that's what the life is right there. You know, again, you can fool people with others, whatever malarkey, but, you know, even winning. I mean, if you're 25-5, that's really good. I mean, that's really, really good. But you know what? If you got a bad locker room, it ain't go good. You know, it ain't good. So that's what, I've been very fortunate with. We've had so many players and assistant coaches that have been, off the charts in terms of quality of people.
Absolutely. Talk to me a little bit about your experience coaching at Army and what that's like and how it maybe was different from your experiences at Evansville and St. Louis, just obviously because of the environment.
Yeah, completely different from this standpoint. It's fundamentally different. When you recruit at schools besides the academies, or certainly West Point, I can't speak for the other one, but I'm sure it's pretty much the same, but in terms of the Naval Academy and the Air Force Academy. But, you know, it's like when you're at a school, it's like you kind of own the players and you're responsible for the players. You know, it's always interesting. A pro guy gets in trouble, the coach never gets in trouble with so-and-so plays for the Pacers or the Knicks or something. The coach doesn't get in trouble. But if they're playing at Evansville or St. Louis or whatever school, Idaho, you know, the coach gets blamed for it. So, but the coach is responsible. So if that's a good thing or bad thing, I'm not quite sure on that one. But at West Point, you do not own those players. That academy owns those players. You borrow them. You borrow them. And fundamentally, that is the right thing, I think, to tell you the truth. It really is. West Point is a place where, to be honest with you, I think so many schools, you always hear the saying where that's where you find yourself. I personally think, and I've always thought this. I personally think that they got invisible neon lights at most of these universities, or if not, I mean, the vast majority of their definition of finding yourself is you, whatever, drink it to death, drug it to death, sex it to death, gamble it to death, whatever to death. And that's not finding yourself. That's losing yourself. At West Point, you find yourself, because every single thing that you do there, you got to earn it. Everything. There is not an easy point academically. There's not an easy thing physically, because I got to do physical things for the military part. There's not an easy thing in terms of responsibility, because you're going to be a leader once you're a sophomore, junior, and senior there, and you're in control of one kid, two kids, or 15 kids in the thing. You are going, and what you find there is just like coaches, parents, teachers, whoever. We can't put a magic wand over anybody's head. Jason can't put it over those three kids' head and say, you're confident. You got to earn confidence. West Point, you earn confidence. You earn it. And those kids become the happiest college kids in America. Even there's a book, I can't remember the book I read the first year I was there, by some guy who was really anti West Point, but he's supposed to do an article for Rolling Stone magazine. He ends up doing a book, and he ended up loving the place. And I can't remember the author's name. This is 20 years ago, so I can't remember, but yeah. He had a classic line in there. He goes, even though West Point cadets complain in epic proportions, they're the happiest kids in college. And that's right, because they feel good about themselves, because they earn. They know they're earning it, and they feel good about it. And that's what makes West Point tremendous. It's a leadership academy, and they're teaching kids how to be leaders, and they have boundaries. The lines are pretty straight and very clear. They're not blurry lines, and they're not crooked lines. And I think that people need those lines. And that's what made West Point absolutely fabulous. And then you get to experience things that you just don't experience at other places. I mean, I went to Iraq and Kuwait, the Middle East, four times with the USO because of West Point. And, you know, seeing soldiers in arm's way in the war zones, that's a different experience. Flying on planes when guy at 3:30 in the morning with 240 guys and girls going to war, and you know, really don't know if they're coming back. That's an experience. So those kids are great. Those kids are good. I just talked to a bunch of them on Veterans Day a couple of days ago. So that was an unbelievable. Have you ever been to West Point, Mike?
I have not been to West Point. I have been to Annapolis. No.
I'd like to live in Annapolis, but West Point, you gotta go see West Point.
And I've been to the Air Force. We played, and when I was at camp, we played at the Air Force Academy. And then I have a friend who he put together these experiences, and that's why I went to the Naval Academy, and also went back out to the Air Force Academy. These are all within the last probably 5-6 years. So just to go in and be able to experience that. And again, I know West Point is obviously, each of them are different, have their own personalities, but you definitely get a feel for what those academies look and feel like in terms of the discipline and just the things that are required of the students and the academic load and all those kinds of things. You can't help but go to, again, the two that I went to, and you can't help but walk out of there just impressed with what you see in every way, shape, or form with the young people that you're interacting with as you walk around that camp, those campuses. It just was, again, it kind of blows you away. Just the fact that when you think about, and you know, you mentioned it earlier, just about going and finding yourself and what we typically think of as, hey, here's what college students are doing and whatever. And then you look at what the, you know, what the people are doing at those academies, what those kids are going through and what they're doing and why they're doing it. And you can't help but leave those places and feel like, wow, the respect that you have for what those kids are doing is just, it's incredible.
That's 100%. I had two different guys, Mike. I had two different guys that had teenage kids that, so they're living on post. You can live on, we lived on post. So it's like, you know, you got the school part, but then there's, you know, you got the fire station, you got the hospital, you got the PX, the grocery store. You got, yeah, I mean, it's like a little village within this post. And so anyway, I had two guys at different times say, they move there. And so I'm just talking to him. He goes, it's amazing. He goes, I got a teenage boy. He goes, his pants are halfway down his rear. He's got his hat on, his body language. And he goes, just being here for a couple months, he goes, all of a sudden he's sitting up straight. His hat's on straight. His pants are up. And he goes, I haven't said a word, but he's seeing other young guys, the cadets, how they're acting. And two different people said the same story to me, which yeah. That's how you're talking about influence. Yeah. It influences a lot of people. And you know what? Those out of all the guys that we recruited there, cause you have a JV team, you got a prep school team. I mean, you're recruiting 15 guys a year to come in, at least 15 to 20 sometimes. I mean, it's amazing how much recruiting you got to do there, but we only had one kid ever that was interested in the military to start. I mean, everyone's, you go in these homes and I mean, they don't know anything about this
right,
stuff,
exactly. But that's,
yeah. But it is the best. I think it's the best school in the country. I really do. I just think it's the best school in the country because it's teaching leadership. It's teaching more than, and their academic load is off the chart. Gee, man, Christmas. I mean, they're taking 22 hours and you're talking about engineering and things that I can't even pronounce. So they're pretty good and fun guys. And fun guys. They're fun. They've been a real joy to my life.
I can imagine. I mean, I can imagine. And again, it's those places you walk out of there, you walk on the ground and you can't help but feel how special they are when you're there. That's all I'll say. I don't know that, again, they're not for everybody, but I think for the people that they're a good fit for, I don't think that you're not going to come out of it with you're going to come out of it with everything that you could ever hope for if it's the right place for you. Let's put it that way.
You know, and that you just made an interesting thing at this point. It's not for everybody. That's how we always recruited every kid that way. Our place is not for everybody. And we don't want it for everybody.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
because these are the standards. This is what we believe in. We're not saying we're better than anyone. We're just saying this is what we believe in. And this is what we're going to do. And this is what we're going to demand. Yep. And And with West Point, too, I mean, you need to go up there just because, I mean, it's beautiful up there. It's on the Hudson River. It's kind of in the mountains a little bit. But they have a saying there. The history department has a saying. The saying is, the history we teach is about the people we taught. Now think about that. Wow. The history we teach is about the people taught. Because all those guys, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, every president's been through. I'm not saying they went to school there, but they've been through there. Everything's been through there. I mean, we're practicing, you know, the superintendent who's the president, he comes to practice and he got some king from some country. I mean, it's like this. So, you know, then there's the Supreme Court judge is there.
Right.
You know, the president of the United States is there and speaks every 4 years or every other year there, basically, or every 3 years, I think it is, he speaks at graduation. So it's a fantastic place. I loved West Point.
That's good stuff. All right, let's finish up here. We're going up on an hour and a half. Let's finish up with some Rick Majerus talk. Tell me about your relationship with Coach Majerus and how you end up being his assistant at St. Louis and then
obviously with his illness and then passing away, and then you take over the job. But just tell me a little bit about your relationship with Coach Majerus and just what made him such a special guy and such a great coach.
Well, I kind of met Rick early. Our freshman year, we played Marquette in the regional down at Vanderbilt, and Rick was an assistant coach then. And then our senior year, the game I talked about earlier down in Baton Rouge in the Final Eight or Elite Eight, I guess they call it Elite Eight, he was an assistant coach. And then he would come down and work Coach Knight's camp. I never worked with him when he worked Coach Knight's camps, but during recruiting and everything, and because he is a big admirer of Coach Knight, just met him through the recruiting. So we, you know, we'd go to eat or we'd sit together at a thing, and we just kind of, and we're kind of completely different guys, but he liked ball and I liked ball, and we always kind of clicked. I don't know why, to tell you the truth, and so forth. And so, and he'd come down to Evansville a few days when we were coaching down there, and we'd just have a good time and everything. So what happened real quickly is, I was out of coaching. We're out of West Point, and we're just living down in Kentucky. And I'll tell you one thing, it was really good. You know, a lot of guys, and this is a good thing, you know, guys will reach out when things don't go well. So if you get fired, it doesn't go well. So, you know, people reach out, but Rick would continue to reach out. You know, he just won a one-time shot. He'd keep reaching out and say how you're doing or ask if you need anything or invite you, or, you know, he got us tickets to a Cardinal. He knew I was a Cardinal fan. And so Kim, my wife, and I would go up there and watch a Cardinal game and, you know, go to private. Anyway, he was great that way. And so I really wasn't looking to get back into coaching. You know, the good Lord kind of takes you in funny places. You know, I'm at West Point. Of all the places to move, we said we'd never move east. So where are we? We're out east. and actually loved it out east. But we, you know, we can live in the south. We live out north. We can live out west. Never the east. We don't want to go east. Well, we're east. So I'm out of coaching. Don't want to get back into coaching really. And Rick was talking to me, and he's trying to get me to come back. And I say no. But then all of a sudden, it's right before the season. Oh, it's probably about 2012, maybe 2011. One of his guys who I knew, he went to the pros, and it's like 3 days before practice starts. So he calls me up. He goes, "Hey, just come here for 4 months." And he's lying about, he's breaks it down to the days, and he's, you know, he's got about 30 days less than it really is. And he goes, anyway, he goes, "Just come over here and do this." He goes, "Just coach." And he knows I like to eat too, but he goes, "We'll eat good," which you knew you're going to eat good with Rick. "So you're going to eat good." He goes, "We're going to laugh a lot." And he goes, "I think we'll be pretty good." So anyway, I go over there, and I'm kind of blind man going over there. I don't know what I'm getting into, but I can take anything for 4 or 5 months, I think. And, go over there, and it was absolutely fantastic experience working for him. He was great, but it was a tough situation from his health. He had had some kind of heart issue. He had 7 bypasses when he was about 40. So now he's 63 years old, and he had some heart issue in the swimming pool. He liked to swim in August. And so he's kind of telling me about it. And they had a foreign trip to Canada, which I wasn't on the staff then, and they went there, but he didn't coach. And then he comes back and he's talking to me about it. He goes, "Yeah, I'm going to get healthier here." The guy said, my doctor said, "I'm going to get healthier in the next 2 or 3 months, do well." And I go, and I looked at him, I go, "Rick, how many coaches do you know get healthier during the season?" And he looks at me, he goes, "Oh, that's a good point." And so anyway, very quickly, the staff, which was tremendous. Jim Weitzel is the head coach at Buffalo. Tanner Bronson's assistant at South Carolina right now. And Jim Platt, who was on our staff, just retired. But anyway, we decided very quickly that Rick was great in practice, but he would wear out. So we went to him and said, "Rick," he goes, "this is what we need to do, we think. This is what we want. Think about this. You just don't even come into the office. Don't even come in." He goes, "We'll take care of everything." He goes, "You just be you at practice. Just be you at practice. That's it." And he kind of bought into it. Now, he'd come in and he'd do a practice plan a little bit, like, you know, noon or 1 o'clock sometimes, or he'd come right before. But he did that. And he is a tremendous teacher. And I'll get to how he and Coach Snyder are a little bit the same and a little bit different in some ways. But I was telling Coach Grube, Dave, the other night, I said, well, it's interesting because Rick is a ball guy. I mean, he talks ball. He wants ball. I mean, ball. He's a ball. He wants to know, you know, he'll drive 4 hours, come down here just to say, well, now how do you change that angle of the screen? Just that one, he had one question and he'd drive 4 hours. I mean, he wanted no ball. So Rick, he always lived in a hotel all his life. I think he was married once for 10 months or a year or something like that. So he's been single. So he lived in a hotel. So he goes out to eat 365 days a year. I mean, literally 365 days. He's out. I mean, so I told the other guys on the staff, I said, hey, my wife's not coming over here that much because I don't know what I'm into right now. So you guys can go home. I'll go with them. So Rick and I would eat 5-6 nights a week together all year. Never talked ball once. And the reason I'm trying to be Dr. Phil here a little bit, but I think that would stress him out. And he knew he could only take so much stress.
Yeah.
The practice and the games. And it worked. He was tremendous. And the difference is interesting. Coach Knight and Rick Majerus are two just incredible teachers. I mean, I really can't imagine any teachers better than those two. I really can't. And I'm talking about any subject. I've had a lot of teachers, not just in sports. I've had a lot of any subject. I mean, they are really, they knew the details. They're both detail oriented. They were very fundamental detail oriented. They were very team oriented. Everything intelligent in terms of thinking the game, for the players to have off the chart. But as I mentioned earlier, Coach, his practice would go boom, 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 from one drill to the next drill to the next drill. Rick was like a clinic. He'd have two guys out there talking about, let's say, contesting. And first of all, he'd say, I was telling Dave this the other day, he'd say, okay, hey, Mike and Jason, I need two guys. I need a guy with the ball on the wing and I need defense. Well, maybe one of them or maybe both of them wouldn't go out there fast. And he'd just kick them, get out of here. Give me two guys that want to play. And so two guys would sprint out there. They just sprint. Well, the guy have a ball and he'd be in a stance with the ball and he'd be ball strong. And the other guy would be in a deep, well, he wouldn't have a ball. Let's say it's a contest. And the other guy would be like contesting, you know, like he'd be arm out, thumb down, right forearm to the stomach, eyes over your left shoulder. See ball, see man. But Rick would talk for 5, 10, 15 minutes. That guy would never get out of his stance. Never. And he would do things like Clint. Like, it just wasn't very many physical things. It was just teach and teach and teach and teach and teach. But it was not very physical. And like, we might do a drill for, let's say, 8 minutes at Indiana or Evan, where I coach, Evansville or West Point, or Coach Knight, 8 minutes, like it might be helping or cover. Rick would spend 40 minutes on it. And then he'd go, man, that's not enough time. Let's go 10 more minutes on it. And so completely different format. But then one thing he would do, as I mentioned, that would be opposite Coach Knight. We really didn't run sprints at Indiana. Rick would have it where one of the funniest things, and this was not at St. Louis. This was when I was an assistant for him with the, 22 and under world game. So we're playing in Australia. So something happens in practice and they're kind of scrimmaging a little bit. And Rick goes, Marcus, that was unbelievable. He goes, the shot goes up. You yell shot. You immediately go to the body and get a body on the offensive player. Then you turn. You got your elbows up, hands up. You got your eyes on the rim. And at the right exact time, you release, go get the ball. You jump, you rip the ball down. You turn halfway in the air. You hear Joe call for the ball. You give a perfect outlet. You sprint to the side. And you're 18 inches from the sideline and you're running and looking over your inside shoulders and you come down the floor and you stop at some point. So he goes on for 5 minutes telling how good this guy is. And he goes, but you stopped a foot too close to the elbow. He goes, give me 20 laps. he just complimented him for 5 minutes. They go, well, give me 20 laps. So they'd get in shape that way. But it was just an amazing thing how he would do it like a clinic almost. And he couldn't stop himself. I mean, in terms of some things, like we'd say, okay, coach, we got a game in like 5 days. We got scrimmage once. We got to go up and down a little bit here, you know? And he said, well, I'll just go over there and sit. I said, yeah, you go over there, because so we couldn't get across half court because he'd stop and say, well, this guy's here. You're not here. So he was absolutely fantastic. Like Coach Knight was in teaching, but completely opposite practice styles, completely opposite. I always heard John Chaney did it like Rick. I never saw Coach Chaney see his practice, but I always heard that he did it that way too. But that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. He was really, really tuned. Those players were very cerebral, and they knew. And Rick would do different things too. He would rarely travel with the team. Rarely. He would just fly on a different flight. He would take a different car, take a different bus or whatever. He would rarely do that. Another thing he would have. So the first is probably an exhibition game, maybe. So I'm the assistant coach there. Mike, and go out there and the team's warming up. Well, first of all, you know, and I know it's a different day and age, but I mean, they don't even have their game jersey on. They got like t-shirts on, like those, whatever they call those t-shirts. You know what I'm talking about? Those tank,
like a shooting
white
shirt.
Wife beaters or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, yep. The ugliest thing, you know, some of them had that, some of them had everything else. They'd have earphones in and they're like, oh my gosh, this is the most whatever. And so I lasted about a game, maybe two games, and then I couldn't go out there. I just like, this is like embarrassing. I mean, there's nothing organized. They're just screwing around. Well, I do enough research, a little investigation. Well, I guess, I don't know if it's brainwashing or what, but Rick had convinced these guys he was there 5 years before I got there, that, you know, he goes, these other teams are going to come out there and they're going to have this organ, you know, they're going to slide here and slide there. And then they're going to have their little shot fake here and they're going to have their little layup here. And some of them are going to act like they're diving on the floor and all this. And they're rah, rah, and cheer and cheer and cheer. And he goes, and he just convinced them that was just a bunch of garbage. He goes, when they throw it up, boys, it's time to play. Let's rock and roll. And I mean, it was like, they thought they were getting the psychological edge on these other guys. These guys are wasting their energy. He goes, when it's time to, and they did. When it's time to play, oh, they played.
That's
they
hilarious. Played. You got to coach to who you are, right? You got to coach your personality. That's what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that was fun how he did it.
That's great stuff. Jim, we are well past an hour and a half. This has been awesome. It's been so much fun. I just want to say thanks to you for being willing to jump on, and shout out to Coach Groove, if he makes it to the end of the episode after listening to this, thanks.
We'll put him to sleep. But I'll tell you what, you played for one of the finest. He is one of my favorite guys. He could coach that game. He loved ball, tremendous teacher, and really cared about the players. And I've met a lot of guys over the year, but he's one of the best. I'll tell you that.
He's definitely been a guy that you know, has had an influence on me. And like I told you in our conversation, it was great for me to be able to reconnect with him recently and kind of get back on one another's radar. And we've been able to see each other a few times over the last year or two. So that's been really cool. And I'm really thankful to him for connecting me to you. And again, I just want to say thanks for taking the time out of your schedule and being a part of the Hoopheads podcast and joining us and jumping on. And it's been a lot of fun. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. And good luck to you and Jason. And I know Jason's in that bed with that daughter of his, they called him. So that's
there
good.
Go.
That's good stuff. Good Absolutely. Luck to you, Mike.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. We appreciate it. And to All everyone right. out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.